course, you know, when the bomb comes, you're not necessarily in your bomb shelter.
Right. You're out shopping or at school or whatever.
Snoozing on the couch, throwing a ball to the dog. Kaboom.
That's the prolific best-selling author T.C. Boyle commenting about the wisdom of having a bomb shelter in a Tel Aviv apartment. Just one of the eclectic topics we talk about during the next hour on Word by Word Conversations with Writers. So stay tuned to KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa or streaming online at krcb.org to hear T.C. Boyle and me, Gil Manser, for a conversation about love, death, and everything in between, as well as the writing of When the Killing's Done, T.C. Boyle's new novel about the ecological battles on Santa Barbara's Channel Islands. Born in Peekskill, New York, Tom Coragagian Boyle, also known as T.C. Boyle, has published 12 novels and more than 100 short stories. He won the Penn Faulkner Award in 1988 for his third novel, World's End, which recounts 300 years in upstate New York. His other novels reflect a particular time and place. The Women is about the life and loves of architect Frank Lloyd Wright at Taliesin East and West. The Road to Wellville focuses on Battle Creek, Michigan cereal maker and health guru John Harvey Kellogg. And The Inner Circle is set in Alfred Kinsey's Sex Institute at Indiana University Bloomington. T.C. Boyle's just released When the Killing's Done takes place on the ecological battleground of Santa Barbara's Channel Islands, specifically the islands of Anacapa and Santa Cruz. T.C. Boyle lives what he writes. His house in Montecito was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. He can see the Channel Islands from the Santa Barbara Hills. He eats breakfast cereal, and since he and his wife have three children, his love life would presumably fit right into Alfred Kinsey's classic book, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, which became a bestseller just a few months before T.C. Boyle was born. T.C., I want to welcome you to KRCB's Word by Word.
Well, thanks, Gil. What a wonderful introduction.
I bet you've never been introduced that way before.
Not exactly. Okay. And I'm very pleased to be back in Santa Rosa. I spent two very happy summers in the 1980s in Guerneville. And I was writing my African book, Water Music, at that time, my first novel. And we didn't have computers back in those days. I don't know if any listener can believe that, but that's the truth.
So you had a portable typewriter?
Portable typewriter. And I had to look up a lot of stuff. And I used the Santa Rosa Public Library. Every couple of days I'd come up and look up what I needed to know right here in town. So it is nice to be back.
Well, good.
Now, as far as my sex life is concerned, you make a big presumption there, Gil, that after – let's see, we're coming up on, I think, our 75th wedding anniversary.
No, it's not quite that.
And I am.
You are 3 years younger than I, so
and
it can't
I am the only writer in American history, as I've said often, only to have one wife. And yes, we are perfectly happy.
Well, actually, there are two of us.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, okay, there are two of us. Well, we're perfectly happy. Everything is great. All three children came as pure accidents, and we are delighted that they came.
Well, we planned ours. We were very careful. We made sure they were at least 4 years apart. One was six. So
did you really?
Yeah, we did.
We never said, gee, honey, let's have kids. Because, you know, at that time I was 30 years old. I was like Woody Allen. You know, I would always say, yeah, okay, theoretically in 10 years because I have to do this, I have to do that. She's the eldest of eight.
Mm-hmm.
Very fertile earth mother kind of woman. And there they are. They're like polywogs or something. I mean, how can you stop this march of – the animals.
Well, they're grown.
That's us.
Now. Aren't they grown?
They're all in their 20s.
Yeah. Any grandchildren on the way?
Oh, please. I don't like this. First of all, I'm way too young to be a grandfather. Secondly.
It happens.
I don't like the concept because it's only one quarter you.
Right.
You know, why couldn't they clone? Why couldn't they clone themselves? I would prefer that.
Well, I suppose it's medically possible.
And you have these strangers involved in your own family. Who needs them? So I'm not looking forward to it, Gil. And so far, no.
Well, okay. Well, let's get on to your book. It is the newest one. We're going to talk about some of the older ones a little later in the show. But we're going to talk and start with When the Killing is Done. And it's an interesting book. It kind of combines, as all yours do, you know, real people in real places with some imaginary, I assume, composites of people.
Yes.
In fact, you see what I did? I had to do a chart to see who was related to who and how.
Oh, very good.
And you start out –
may I keep that?
Yeah, I'll give you that.
When
sure.
we're all done sure. today? Yeah, sure. I'll keep that for the archives.
On board the Beverly Bee, we start out with Beverly Boyd and Till Boyd, her husband, and a friend.
That's correct. This story that begins the novel is a set piece of maybe 35 pages, and it's very exciting. It has to do with something that I read about in a wonderful book called The Shipwrecks of the Santa Barbara Channel.
Right.
And they went out – I've, of course, made up characters and identities, but the actual people and the actual news accounts, they went out for a weekend in their cabin cruiser, 1946, out to Santa Cruz. They were going to spend the weekend catching abalone, now extinct, unfortunately, and lobsters, soon to be extinct, and fish, soon to be extinct. And they ran into some weather. Their boat capsized. She watched her husband and brother-in-law drown before her eyes. She was drowning herself when up popped an ice chest that she bought from Sears Roebuck, guaranteed for life. She held on to it, and the currents,
and
very cold water.
Rode it like a barrel.
Very cold water. She washed up on Anacapa, which is all cliffs, and she couldn't get up out of the water. So she spent a miserable night freezing there, clinging to a cliff. Next day, she got back in the water, went down the side of the island, and finally got to a place where she could get up ashore and found a fisherman's shack.
I'm going to have you read a little clip from that.
Okay, good. However, the fisherman was not there.
Yeah, that's right.
It was 2 weeks there before she was rescued. And that's how the book begins. And since you've got this genealogy there, the reader doesn't know this yet, but in the next chapter, we're introduced to Alma Boyd Takasui, who is one of the biologists for the Park Service and is in charge of eliminating the invasive species on both Anacapa and on Santa Cruz. And she will be opposed by Dave LaJoy, an animal rights activist who feels that no animal should be killed under any circumstances, no matter what the reason.
Except a human, maybe.
He doesn't like people that much. I'll have to admit it. And this is a conundrum that I've talked about also in A Friend of the Earth, for instance.
Right.
In A Friend of the Earth, we have an eco-saboteur from the 80s, and we project to 2025 when now he's an old man. And he says, to be a friend of the earth, you have to be an enemy of the people. And of course, the problem with preserving the environment for our enjoyment is that there are too many of us.
Absolutely. But the point is, whatever you or I or any person, you know, who decides that they are blessed in some way or know more than the rest of us, who decides to do something, is going to have a long-term effect they can't predict.
That's exactly right. So this book, in short, is about island biogeography and how when you add a species or remove a species from a closed ecosystem, there can be catastrophic and or unforeseen results.
Right. Well, let's pick up Beverly Boyd. She has floated to shore. She's climbed up a rusty steel ladder that was sent down one of the cliffs, and she has found an abandoned house that was left there by previous farmers and ranchers.
Actually, it was by Frenchie.
Okay.
Frenchie, the fisherman.
The fisherman.
But he occasionally
would – Well, did he build the place?
Yes.
Okay.
He occasionally would go into Santa Barbara every 6 months or something to get some canned tomatoes and some supplies. And it just happened that during this two-week interval, he was not there.
Right. Let's read it. This is by the way, she's 2 months pregnant at this time?
Yes.
Yes.
She's also 2 months pregnant, and she, if she had drowned, then we would not have had her granddaughter, Alma.
Right. So it's start to stop. It's really simple.
Okay. Very good. In the next moment, she rose and went round the corner of the house to the door at the front, thinking to clothe herself, thinking there must be something inside to cover up with, rags, a bedsheet, an old towel, or a fisherman's sweater. But what if there were people in there? What if there was a man? No man on this earth had seen her naked, but for the doctor who delivered her, and Till. And what would she say to Till if there was a man there to see her, as she was now? She hesitated, uncertain of what to do. For a long moment, she regarded the door in its stubborn inanimacy, a door made of planks nailed to a crosspiece, weather-scored and unrevealing. Beside it, set in the wall at eye level, was a four-pane window so smeared as to be nearly opaque. But she shifted away from the door, cupped her hands to the glass, and peered in, all the while feeling as if she were being watched. Inside, she could make out a crude kitchen counter with a dishpan and an array of what looked to be empty bottles scattered atop it. And beyond that, a sagging cot decorated with an army blanket. A second window, facing north, drew the glare in off the ocean. She tapped at the glass, hoping to forestall anyone who might be lurking inside. Finally, she tried the door, whispering, "Hello? Is anybody home?" There was no answer. She lifted the latch and pushed open the door to a rustle of movement, dark shapes inhabiting the corners, a spine-sprung book on the floor, shelves, cans, a sou'wester on a hook that made her catch her breath, fooled into thinking someone had been standing there all along. It took a moment for her eyes to adjust, the shapes manifesting themselves all at once, furred, quick-footed, tails naked and indolently switching, a host of darkly shining eyes fastening on her without alarm or haste, because she was the interloper here, the beggar. She was the one naked and washed up like so much trash, and she let out a low exclamation. Rats. She'd always hated rats, from the time she was in kindergarten and her mother warned her against going near the garbage bins set out in the alley behind their apartment building. They bite babies, her mother had told her. Big girls, too. Nip their toes, jump in their hair. You know Janie, upstairs in 7B? They got in her cradle when she was a baby, right here, right in this building. Her father reinforced the admonition, taking her by the hand and probing with one shoe in the dim corners of the carport so she could see the animals themselves, the corpses of the ones he'd caught in spring traps baited with gobs of peanut butter. In secret, in the dark, they would lick and paw that bait, peanut butter, the same peanut butter she ate on white bread with the crust cut off, until the guillotine dropped and the blood trailed from their crushed heads and dislocated jaws. Rats. Disease carriers, food spoilers, baby biters. But what were they doing here, on an untamed island set out in the middle of the sea? Had they swum, sprouted wings? The thought came and went. She flapped her arms savagely. Get out, she shouted, rushing at them, whirling, clapping her hands. Get! They blinked at her. There must have been a dozen or more of them. And then, very slowly, as if it were an imposition, as if they were obeying only because in that moment her need was stronger than theirs, they crept back into their holes. But she was frantic now, snatching the blanket up off the cot without a thought for the rattling dried feces that fell like shot to the floor, and wrapping it around her even as she fumbled through the cans on the shelf, peaches and syrup, Boston baked beans, creamed corn, and the utensils tossed helter-skelter in a chipped enamel dishpan set on the counter.
Aha. I think you need to give, I realize we probably should have done this up front. I'm not sure all of our listeners know about the Channel Islands, where they are between Point Conception and Oxnard. Hmm. Basically, straight out from Santa Barbara is the island of
Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz.
It's the big one you see there.
Below that is a very almost barren, desolate island, no water, Anacapa.
Mm-hmm.
See, north of Santa Cruz is
the next island
up. Santa Rosa.
Is Santa Rosa, and then the farthest out, San Miguel.
Right.
When I first told the fiction editor at the New Yorker, Deborah Treisman, that I was not going to be writing some stories for a while because I was working on an island on a book about the Channel Islands, she assumed I was talking about the English Channel Islands.
Oh, uh-huh. Well, there's several Channel Islands around the world.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, in order to help people out, we have included a map.
Uh-huh.
Again, even people who live on the coast of California have not visited the islands for the most part, and a lot of them don't really know much about them. But you go into the interior of California and then to Nevada, Iowa, Maine. You know, people know nothing about this. And furthermore, you know, this book will be translated into many languages in Europe and around the world. So I'm giving a sort of lesson as to where they are and what they are and, again, providing the map.
Well, I've never heard them referred to before as the Galapagos of the North America or something like that.
The biologists like to say this, and it
because
is true.
Because 11 miles is the closest distance to shore, and they have developed their own ecosystem over the
exactly.
years.
Exactly. Exactly. As with the Galapagos, which of course is far, much farther out.
Right.
But nonetheless, the ecosystem has evolved along the principles of island biogeography as put out by E.L. Wilson and others. That is, animals in a closed ecosystem will either become larger or smaller depending on the new niche that they will fulfill. So the poster animal here is the Channel Islands fox,
mm-hmm.
which is the size of a small house cat, 4 to 6 pounds. On Santa Rosa, they have found the tusks of the dwarf mammoth. The mammoth, presumably, like elephants today, swam out to the islands. Became established there, and over the eons, developed a dwarf variety. Now, it's still 6 feet at the shoulder.
Yeah, but it's possible that the amount of water between the islands was lower.
This has been taken into account, and it is possible, so it wasn't as biggest swim.
Right.
But nonetheless, they could not have walked there, so they do presume that they swam there. We have a blue jay, like our scrub jay on the coast, on the island. It's one-third larger than our blue jay,
mm-hmm.
and a lot bluer. And this is just a kind of genetic variation of an inbred species that's been there for
more like
God
the
knows
bluebird in the East Coast, that kind of bright blue?
Not exactly, right. but bluer than our scrub jay.
Okay, so we have these islands off the coast. They have their own ecosystem. And until humans arrive, and they arrived with the Chumash Indians we know, mm-hmm. and maybe even earlier than that.
They're talking 14,000 years now,
yeah.
which is the second oldest site they've found in the Americas,
right.
I believe.
The Chumash were on the islands for a long time. So.
Yeah, and it's fun to talk about they discovered. Who are they anyway? Some wonderful archaeologist somewhere right now digging in that dry old dirt, you know?
Yep.
There's a lot of Chumash remains in the islands. They had been privately owned, these islands, and over the years people had raided and all the middens and so on. But yet I was out there recently to do a little interview and a video for the Nature Conservancy regarding this book. And we just went to this little promontory to take some photos against the ocean. And right there was a huge midden with, you know, arrowheads and all this stuff just scattered about. So this was populated for a long while. We don't know, 1,000 years?
Yeah.
The first remains were 14,000 years ago.
Right. So a long time.
Mm.
And they probably went back and forth to the coast because they used those boats that they made
Tomoles.
Right.
They made out of a hollowed out log.
Yeah. Now
– they must have been great mariners, Gil, because
it depends on the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although you can start out in an hour out, all of a sudden everything changed. I know a lot about the islands because I've got a good close friend who lives in Sebastopol named Tom Kendrick, who wrote a book called Blue Water Gold Rush, which I think you know.
I know it because I credit it right here as one of the texts
actually,
I used.
I was talking with Tom on the radio. I said, I'm going to be interviewing T.C. Boyle. Is it okay if I give him your book? He says, sure, yeah. I've always wanted, you know, to make sure he got one. And then when I opened yours, there was his name.
It's a wonderful book, and I got information about urchin diving mm-hmm. from this mm-hmm. and used one story that Tom tells in the book, and I transformed it a little bit.
To
the islands.
Right.
And so that it would reflect on the characters that I have here. I also have been lucky enough to know many urchin divers mm-hmm. in Santa Barbara just as friends.
Well, you kind of fall over them when you go down.
It's true. Wharf, that's right. Absolutely right. And so I got a lot of information about urchin diving in that from this book and from friends whom I have.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been out with them, though, and I've never done any diving for urchin myself. I would like to at some point.
Well, Tom says they would frequently, when they had to, you know, dock and walk around and go sunbathing or whatever else, they would find Chumash remains, the same kind of thing. It did not take much to, you know where to go and search them out. In fact, he writes a chapter called The Curse of the Chumash, which means that anyone who takes things off the island will have bad luck.
Yeah. You know, it's a shame that the Chumash didn't have McDonald's and stuff like that because then we could go see the old plastic buildings.
Right.
But they didn't have
They'd still
like
be
that.
There.
They whatever.
Or if they'd had a casino, you know, they would still
right.
be there
they'd
too.
They'd still be there.
And it was enough offshore that they probably would have lasted through the laws of California prohibiting gambling.
Absolutely. But, of course, their dwellings were made out of natural materials and are long gone. But we do have these middens and their stone tools.
Okay, let's go back to Beverly Boyd. She was stuck in a little fisherman's shack and was surprised to find that it was inhabited by dozens and dozens of black rats.
Yes.
How did they get on the island when it's 11 miles from the coast?
This is a wonderfully leading question, Bill.
I thought it might be.
So we begin with the first shipwreck and then
– well, at one of the first shipwrecks.
Of
but
the
yes,
Beverly
but in,
Bay.
But in your book,
but
I
then
think it's
the second,
oldest shipwreck.
Third chapter is the wreck of the Winfield Scott.
Right.
And this was a paddle wheel steamer coming from San Francisco to Panama pre-canal so that people could go across Panama and get another steamer up the East Coast. And a lot of them were 49ers, guys who'd been up here in the gold fields and they had their gold with them.
Mm-hmm.
The boat went aground in a fog on Anacapa Island. No one was killed. Most of the gold was recovered. But they were there for a few days on a rock off the island and then on the island itself. Meanwhile, though, the ship went down, and all of its rats.
Several thousand, you estimate.
Well, we don't know. No, ultimately, their descendants were about 3,000 on the island, but we don't know how many were in the ship. As I say, all it would take was one pregnant female.
Right.
Anyway, the rats got there as an invasive species and colonized the island. And in 2001, which starts the plot of this book, the Park Service—
Let's go back a step. Oh, if it had been one pregnant female, and I thought of this when I read it, wouldn't they be inbred and they would then be a biological entity unto themselves?
They would be. Oh, why? Right. Just like Adam and Eve.
Right.
Yes, they would be. And then there's the question of, do they belong there? Do they belong because all the other animals that are there, that inhabit islands, have gotten there—
Accidentally.
By rafting, yeah. Accidentally, and
or
whatever.
Flying.
And this does come up toward the end of the
or
book.
Or swimming.
That's right. This does come up toward the end of the book. So that's a great question. Had they been a special strain of rat, then they would need to have been preserved. So you see, the question that I'm asking is, who has the right to make these determinations? What's determinations? What's your baseline? Who decides when an animal is valuable or not valuable? All of this.
Mm-hmm.
So at any rate, the Park Service decided there are black rats all over the world. But the ground nesting birds that evolved in the absence of predators on Anacapa were being preyed upon by these rats. They eat their eggs and their nestlings. So they decided to bomb the island with Brodifacum, rat poison, decon.
Bright blue.
Bright
blue. Keep the birds away. They won't see it, theoretically.
Bright blue. In a time when there aren't many birds around in November. Because the birds had gone off elsewhere. They had trapped the native deer mouse population.
Mm-hmm. And were going to reintroduce them.
So this kicks off my plot because in real life and in my telling, I've invented a character based on what I read about in the newspaper about a real life animal rights activist who went out there, and this is my Dave LaJoy, with a Confederate with big backpacks full of kibble and vitamin K, which is the antidote, the rat poison, and scattered it all over to try to save the rats.
Strange. We had termites, so we had, you know, Terminex come out. And when he's there, he says, well, you know, I can set some rat traps because I see you've got some tree rats. And he says, but do you have a cat? I said, no. He says, good. Okay. Then I can put some bait out too. Well, I thought
secondary poisoning.
I thought that too. He was going to set the bait out and didn't want the cat to get into it. No, he told me that cat food has a high level of vitamin K in it.
Ah.
And that if
the rats would keep eating that,
the poison would be ineffective.
Well, Dave LaJoy is against the killing of anything. He's a highly flawed character.
Well, depending. When he puts in a brand new sawed lawn, he has a difficult time.
Well, he's a real kind of character who has contradictions, you know, unlike you and me who are perfect.
No. We understand. We know what we're doing.
Yeah. He doesn't want to see the rats killed, and he feels that decon is very cruel. It makes the animal bleed out. If you've ever seen this, it's not pretty. And there is secondary poisoning. Your cat could have eaten a rat and then died itself.
Or the birds or whatever.
But once he puts in his new lawn, there are holes in it. And he realizes that raccoons are digging it up to get at the grubs and under the lawn. So he live traps them and then has to find out where he's going to release them. But he will not kill any animals.
Well, I thought there was some question when the gophers arrived. He was having serious doubts about it.
Then the gophers arrive and the exterminator, the guy who comes over to advise him, says, yeah, well, you know, we can trap these things, but we just kill them. But the book does not say whether Dave elected to do this
or not.
No,
I know. I think he's left with a conundrum there.
Yep.
Yes, that's right. Whether I have mounds on my brand new sod lawn,
which
he didn't really want to put in because it took a lot of water, and there's not a lot of water in the region, as you know, and having gone through a couple of droughts at least.
Yeah, and you know, there's a great conundrum here too, Gil, because – all right, so he eliminates the raccoons. Then we get down to the gophers. What about, you know, bugs, anything, any form of life? We control everything. You know, the epigraph to the book, which I guess I could read at this juncture if you don't mind.
Sure.
Sets up all of the thematic elements of the book and gives me a kind of starting point. I had this epigraph before I began to write. It's a way of stating what I'm going to be meditating on in this book because I don't know what it will be. I'm interested in something, and I'm going to create a story to kind of discover what it's about.
You didn't know your characters in advance?
Nothing. I know nothing. I just begin. By that time, I might start to jot things down, but they develop as I go along. So the epigraph is from Genesis 1:28. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Now, since the Bible was written in retrospect, after people already did have dominion over a lot of the creatures of the earth.
Or wanted to.
Then perhaps this is an explanation after the fact. But nonetheless, this is one of the foundations of our culture. And I'm just wondering, what is that right of our particular animal species to dominate all the rest and to do with them what we will, to breed dogs into 9,000 varieties, to capture them, to hold them, to eliminate one species in a national park and in favor of another, raise hogs in a factory where they never see the light of day and have no life like it's some science fiction movie. What are the ethics of this? And so this is why I've written the book, to just meditate on that.
I don't think you come to any conclusions, which is great. I mean, you set people up. I think your activist is probably the most villainous, but he's just because he's a cantankerous, orny SOB. I
mean, he's an angry fellow.
He's very angry.
But, you know, on the other end, Alma is highly imperfect also. She's imperfect because she's a perfectionist and she can't let go. And they're both very hard-headed, even though they both have the same goal, which is to preserve animals, preserve the environment. They're vegetarians. They once had a small alliance.
Yes.
But now they're enemies over this one fact. Should the animals that are invasive be removed, killed, in order to spare the endemic species, which are so very rare and in danger of extinction, or should every life be sacred and nothing eliminated?
Well, I'm not sure it's limited to this philosophical difference, because you have a scene where they go out to have dinner together. Could you mind reading that for us?
Oh, I'd be delighted.
Okay.
When Alma had first come to town to get the job with the Park Service, she didn't know anybody. And she lived in a small part of Santa Barbara, which is its own village. And she had a favorite restaurant, an Italian restaurant in the village where she felt safe. She'd gone there alone and with girlfriends and so on. And when she first met Dave, she liked him. He's a good-looking guy.
Mm-hmm.
They were at a folk club. They both love folk music. They're both into the environment and animals. And so he asked her on a date. And she said, yes, okay, but we must go to my restaurant. Because, of course, she didn't know who this guy is and what might happen.
Right.
And the result is what you have picked out for me to read.
Okay, let's start with You're the Sommelier.
Very good. You're the Sommelier? LaJoy seemed to be glaring at him. I'd like a bottle of the Brunello di Montalcino Riserva, 1988. The Castello Ruggiero, the one here. Pointing to the bottom of the last page of the letter-bound wine list. He raised an admonitory finger. But only if you've got more than one on hand, because there's nothing more disappointing than ordering a top-end wine and getting to the bottom of the bottle only to have the waiter try to substitute something else. Yes, Giancarlo said in answer to both questions. This is one of our rarest and finest wines, and we do have at least a few bottles on hand, I'm quite sure. And then he attempted a witticism, which was lost on LaJoy. If you should consume them, I would be more than just happy, perhaps even rhapsodic, and I will personally drive back to the house and get you yet another from my personal cellar. Through all this, Alma had held on to her smile, but she began to view LaJoy, Dave, in a new light. He was agitated, she could see that. But why? Was he trying some sort of power play, putting down Fredo and now Giancarlo himself? As if this would impress her? But Giancarlo was gone now to fetch the wine. Wine, she saw, glancing at the list she eased from the table, that cost $325 a bottle. And she tried to let the moment pass. I'm sure it'll be good, she said, forcing a different kind of smile altogether, a smile that was two parts reassurance and one of unease. All he said was, It better be at these prices.
You are listening to Word by Word Conversation with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa, where tonight's conversation is with T.C. Boyle, who is sharing how he created his newest novel, When the Killing's Done, The Ecological Battles on Santa Barbara's Channel Islands. So stay tuned right here to KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa or streaming online at krcb.org.
And then Giancarlo was back, taking on the burden himself, presenting the bottle against a snowy cloth. He held it out for LaJoy's approval, then uncorked it and discreetly slipped the cork onto the table beside his plate. LaJoy snatched it up, sniffed at it with a sour look, and set it back down again. Then there was the ritual of the trial pour and LaJoy's lifting the glass to his nose, holding it up to the light and swirling the wine to aerate it. It was as dark and viscous as the blood at the bottom of the polystyrene tray steak comes in at the supermarket, the steak she hadn't seen or consumed since she was a teenager because it was against her principles. And then, finally, tasting it. She watched his face expectantly. Giancarlo was watching, too, solicitous, more proper than proper, waiting for the command to pour the glasses full. But LaJoy's expression was pained. He took a second sip, rinsed his mouth, and spat it back into the glass. "Rotgut," he pronounced. Giancarlo said nothing. He stood there erect. The restaurant, his life's blood, his pride, his being, opening up behind him to the gracious tables of murmuring diners, the paintings spotlighted on the deep ochre walls, the potted palms and lacy ferns. She didn't know what to do. Certainly she couldn't demand to taste it herself, or even request it. LaJoy was the expert here. He was the one paying. This was a date, a dinner date, and she had to defer to him. But he was rude, no doubt about it. Unnecessarily so. No, boorish. Absolutely boorish. He didn't say anything in extenuation, not, "Excuse me, I'm very sorry, and I know this rarely happens, but please bear with me here," or even, "It must have turned in the bottle." He merely flicked his wrist as if brushing away an insect and dropped his eyes once again to the wine list. This time he ordered a French wine, the second priciest bottle on the list, and this time it was Fredo who presented the bottle and assisted in his rigidly decorous way with the ritual of the uncorking, the examination of the cork, the pouring of the sample taste. And this time, without even glancing at the waiter, LaJoy, his lip curled and his gaze locked on hers, said only, "Vinegar." And when he did look up, his eyes burning with the kind of fanatical hatred you saw in the eyes of revolutionaries, he pronounced his words very carefully, fighting for restraint. "Bring me the list."
Mm-hmm. So do you like that man?
I love and worship all of my characters because they are my children, and I've created them all.
Right.
And I will leave it for the reader to decide.
Let's put it this way. Did you put that piece in there, that set piece, which gives you an insight into his anger, which is not directed only at
those? He is angry at everything. One of these guys who is just purely angry at everything, and his cause is animal rights. It could have been something else, but it's animal rights.
Now, tell us why that happened. It's because the description of the events that led to it is that someone brought a pamphlet into his store, and he sells high-end hi-fi equipment and TV, you know, home.
Yes, he's been successful enough to be fairly comfortable. He's started a chain, a local chain of four high-end video audio stores. And he had a college girl working for him.
Right.
And one day he came in, and she was handing out pamphlets to the customers. He was outraged. Then he took one and read it, and had a kind of revelation, because it was a kind of PETA document.
Mm-hmm.
And it documents
– with lots of photos.
With lots of photos of what actually happens in the slaughterhouses, what we're actually doing to animals. And it transformed him. Now, it didn't make him any less angry. In fact, it made him angrier. But this was his one subject. And
so he became an instant true believer.
Exactly. And he will fight for it unendingly. And so we have the conflict of the book.
You earlier in our discussion mentions the word eco-terrorist, right, referring to one of your previous books.
Eco-saboteur.
Eco-saboteur. All right. This man becomes an eco-saboteur. You mentioned the raccoon, which he caught on his lawn.
Well, we don't want to give too much away, Gil.
We don't want to give that too much away.
But yes, he does,
but
because
he
will do anything to get back at what he feels is wrong, the killing of the rats on Anacapa, and then the larger killing that goes on Santa Cruz Island, which involved first removal of the sheep, which were grazing everything down to nothing, and the bringing of them to the mainland safely. But, of course, I'm sure a lot of them wound up as lamb chops. But then more to the point, the killing of the 5,500-odd feral pigs that had been there for 150 years. And as you mentioned with your proposition regarding the rats, this was an isolated population of pigs. Mm-hmm. So they could not risk bringing them back to the shore for whatever purpose. They had to kill them and leave them there because it might be that over 150 years, this special new breed of swine might have developed viruses, parasites, whatever, that might infect our pork industry. So,
and we couldn't possibly put them in quarantine or anything like that.
They never even thought about it because of the danger of even putting them on our soil. You know what hoof and mouth disease is like and how—
And the pork industry, who's very protective.
Exactly.
And California even more so.
Exactly. And by the way, we should point out to the listeners that this is my fictional account of what actually happened. So these events actually happened with regard to the removal of these various species.
So did the hunters come from New Zealand?
Yes. The hunters came from New Zealand. They are a professional group who specialize in trying to remove invasives from islands. And, of course, you know, the New Zealandish and the Aussies have a lot
they know a lot
about this.
There's an awful lot of rabbits in Australia.
That's right, because of all the invasive species. They were hired at a cost, in my fiction and in real life, of $7 million to come in and successively fence off and clean off Santa Cruz Island, which is four times bigger than Manhattan, and kill the pigs and leave them to rot. This was a decision made by the Nature Conservancy and the Park Service in order to prevent the extinction of the island fox. And in my telling, Dave LaJoy protests this rather vigorously and in a very underhanded way, and he does become a kind of echo saboteur, as you suggest. But I wouldn't want to get into
the absolute
specifics because it will spoil some of the joy of this for the reader.
They're going to find that out for themselves. We're just setting up the characters. We've met Beverly Boyd. We briefly heard about Till, who drowned, I think about four pages in or something like that. Her daughter is Kat, who marries Greg Takasui, who anyway, you end up with an awful lot of single mothers who have to raise their daughters on their own. And someone leaves, they get separated, there's a horrible accident, whatever the reasons, they are raising the young girls who to teenagehood and beyond on their own.
That's quite right. And Greg dies in an accident while gathering sea urchins. It's was an actual incident, which Tom tells in his book as well. And it was an inspiration for me to, as a way to kill off Greg Takasui, so that we could have, as you suggest, two sets of mothers and daughters who feel they have a possessive stake in these islands, and so it makes the fight over them even more intense.
So the counterpoint, the same age group approximately, is Rita Reed, who we never really see the father there. They've separated by the time we meet her. But she has a daughter named Anise Reed, who becomes a songwriter.
Or
singer.
Anise.
And she becomes very close, we'll say, with Dave LaJoy, his girlfriend.
Yes. She's a folk singer. She's a very dramatic performer, maybe not of the very first stripe, but she is –
certainly
locally
Santa Barbara,
well known.
Yeah, well known.
Plays
right.
Cold Spring Tavern and places like that. She has a lot of hair. And
all
she's
the way
a
down.
Big woman.
Yep.
A big woman with a big face, and she's kind of a beauty, and she performs barefooted. And Dave doesn't even like folk music that much, a little bit, but not her brand so much. But he's captivated by her when she performs, and they realize, as he did with Alma, that they have a lot in common in terms of their feeling about vegetarianism. She's a vegan and about the environment.
And the reason she's a vegan is because she used to live on Scorpion Ranch on the island.
Exactly.
And they raised sheep.
When she was a girl, she was completely oblivious to all this. She was 9 years old. She lived out there with her mother, who was a former musician herself. And the mother allied herself with the guy who was the sheep rancher out there, even though he was considerably older than her, Bax.
Right.
And there are a couple of rather grueling scenes of
We could call it traumatic.
Traumatic scenes. And this turned her off to meat forever.
Right.
And, you know, novelists love traumatic scenes. We're born to make traumatic scenes. One of the joys of art in general, movies, books, novels, is that we novelists can make the most horrific things happen to other characters in a kind of voodoo way. The reader hopes it's not going to happen to them, and we hope that it's not going to happen to us.
Right.
And so we can indulge in these fantasies because, after all, we do live in a universe ruled by accident, and anything can happen at any time. For instance, in A Friend of the Earth, one of the Echo Saboteurs, who is sort of a bad guy, dies much later in this way. A tiny, tiny fragment of a meteorite comes burning through his kitchen roof, through the back of his head, and incinerates the basement floor. While I was writing the book, I had heard of an incident in my hometown of Peekskill, New York, on the Hudson River, in which a guy was sitting outside the pizza shop in his car. The car jolted, and he went out and looked. And a little fragment of meteorite had come down, burned through the back hood, the trunk, and into the pavement below. And I figured, all right, if it did that, it
could, and he were in there in the trunk.
Yeah, right. It could come any moment, anywhere. Anything can happen. And so one of the joys of making art is that I control that universe, whereas nobody controls this one, and we're all victims and all at a loss. As Jim Morrison said, nobody gets out alive.
Okay, let's look at this book specifically and how you approached it. You said you didn't have a story when you began. You really didn't have characters. Did you have an incident in mind that set to make sure you wanted to include?
Of course.
Yeah.
Typically, I never know what any story will be that I'm telling. It evolves. It's organic. However, typically a book like this would take maybe 3 months of intense research. So I'll read many, many texts. I mentioned 10 of them here that were inspirational to me.
You call historians and memoirists or memoirists.
That's right. Memoirs and histories of the Channel Islands. A lot of them unpublished stuff that is now published by the Santa Cruz Island Foundation. Run by Marla Daly, our local historian, who is just a marvel. She's wonderful. So much information. So I'll take notes and so on as if I were writing a term paper. It's exactly like that. And in some cases, with this book, of course, or with Drop City, which is set in Alaska, I will have to go to the place and see it and experience it as much as I can.
Right.
And in the process of all of that, maybe on some level, consciously, I'm making some connections, and unconsciously too. So then something is set in motion. We read the epigraph, which gives me a kind of thematic overlay, and something is set in motion. And here, as you suggest, I had the actual newspaper stories about the rat savior, the guy who actually went out and threw the vitamin K on the island.
So do you keep this? I mean, I'm going to ask you.
Yes.
Is this in a file folder or something?
Yes,
like
of
that?
Course, yeah. And a big notebook. But the problem is once the notes are all taken and the newspaper accounts are in there, I rarely look at them again. I'll go through them two or three times before I start, but I rarely look at them again because I'm going now in a different direction.
Because you're creating something similar but not identical.
That's right. And another interesting factor here is the characters are mine. I'm creating them. They're my creatures. And of all the people I've met with regard to this situation, the biologists and so on and so on, none of them are represented here. I'm making up characters. I don't want to represent people. I'll give you an example. The guy, the New Zealish guy who ran ProHunt, is apparently a very nice man who would be happy to talk to me. And I was going to. But then I realized I didn't really want to because I might imagine him. So I've invented a character, and I have no idea whether this character is anything like him whatsoever. But the facts of what he did and the kind of gun he used and the amount of money he were paid, this was all part of the public record of the newspaper.
Right.
So at some point, you want to draw back from that.
And you actually have a reporter for the local newspaper who you use as a character in here to kind of document things and put things out to the public at large so everybody knows what's going on.
Yes, I do. And a couple of journalists have by the way, this book has been well received. People are kind of loving this and getting into the story and its newness and freshness, et cetera, et cetera. But at least one journalist said that I had some something against journalists because she is a figure of some satire in this book. But that's not necessarily true. It just happened that from the point of view of Dave and from Alma, who also
– Are you talking about the one who would wear the high heels, hiking up the side of the hill?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. She's a journalist. She smokes cigarettes and dyes her hair and works in an office. And she's covered this first for Alma. Mm-hmm. And now Dave has co-opted her. And yeah, I suppose the portrait of her is somewhat harsh and amusing, but that's just the way it went.
I think she's just pursuing the story.
Exactly. And I have nothing against anybody, really, especially those who buy my books. I love them most of all. It just turns out that way.
Right. Just coincidence.
Well, I'm also an equal
opportunity. Well, yeah, but the problem is you've only got one newspaper in town, really.
That's right. And I'm an equal opportunity satirist. You know, if you give me long enough, I'll have fun with just about everything and everybody.
Good.
Including myself.
So when you teach, and you still do teach.
Yes, I do.
You teach creative writing?
I teach creative writing. That is fiction, a fiction workshop. I'm down to two classes a year, one day a week at USC.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the first writer they ever had there, and I established the undergrad writing program, of which I'm very proud. I love it. I love my students, and I want to continue doing it into the future if I can. It's incredibly rewarding. I get to sit with a group of people who want to do the same thing that I'm doing. They are incredibly gifted, and I get to get out of my own house and my own head and be able to talk with people about the art that I love the most.
Now, you went through Iowa with John Irving and James Cheever, was that right?
I was at Iowa for 5.5 years. I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop, and I simultaneously got my PhD in English literature of the 19th century. And my mentors in the writing workshop were first Vance Bergeli, who was the teacher of John Irving, who had been there some years before me.
Gotcha.
And now John was still in town and teaching. So I had John, and then I had John Cheever, who was teaching in academia for the first time ever, I believe. I think he had taught his class at Sing Sing once, but he hadn't been in academia, and he didn't like academia because his formal education ended at the age of 17 when he was kicked out of the Thayer Academy for smoking. And he would always tell me, by the way, he would always try to convince me not to get a PhD because he felt that art and the critical part of it are at variance, at
mm-hmm.
odds.
Mm-hmm.
And to a degree, he was right. But I felt that I could handle that, and I really wanted to be informed about English literature because I really didn't know anything, and I thought it would help my writing. As it turned out, I've never taught in my specialty area, never had a desire to. There was such a demand for fiction writing, and that is what has consumed my life.
So are there authors who you turn to in your mind as you're writing? Someone who's really influenced you in any
there
time?
There are many, many, many writers.
And they don't have to be 19th century mm-hmm. luminaries.
Many, many, many writers have influenced me and continue to influence me, of course. It's in a similar process. You know, you've got to put something in to get something out. We were talking about Cheever.
Mm-hmm.
When I met Cheever, you know, I was an errant young punk with the word experimental on my lips every 3 seconds. And I had read Cheever, some of Cheever's work earlier, and really had dismissed it. He was an old man. He was irrelevant. Who cared, you know? I was much more into the work of Barth, Barthelmay, Coover, Gunter Grass, Julio Cortázar and García Márquez and Calvino and all of these really wild, great, great writers. A few years later, though, John published his collected stories.
Uh-huh.
And I read them from beginning to end. And I've probably done that 3 times in my life now. And I have just such a profound respect.
You've read the collection three or four times?
Yeah, yeah. For a profound respect for what he was doing and the way he encapsulated his era so beautifully. He also said to me, in his own voice, in reference to himself, you know, I'm an experimental writer too. All writers are. And of course, he is. Mm-hmm. Look at the death of Justina, for instance, how wonderful that story is. And so I think I've acquired a more Catholic taste over the years. I can work in any mode. You know, I never wrote in a realistic mode before, but I do and can now and always try to push myself in new directions. So it's time for you to ask me What are you working on now?
I was going to go right there. Actually, I was going to start with short stories and then go right there. But let's go there first. Yeah. What are you working on now for the long piece?
Yeah. I began a novel last July, and I finished the first two sections of three and came to a breathing spot just before going off on this tour, which, of course, you know, it's impossible to be working on tour because it's very demanding.
Yes.
I've never written a sequel. This is not a sequel. It's not a companion piece to this. But it is also set on the Channel Islands because I discovered a story, an historical story, set on San Miguel. And so I'm telling that. The book is called San Miguel, and it's something I've never tried before. It's a straightforward historical narrative, sans irony and sans black humor.
So can I do this? Historical fiction?
Yes. Can I do this? Can I write an historical narrative that doesn't turn the historical novel on its head, as of course I've done with mm-hmm. my first novel, Water mm-hmm. Music and right. World's End and so on. I just want to see if I can do that, and because I've never done it before. And I think
– So you're trying to be restrictive
yes.
on yourself?
Exactly.
Yeah.
To see what will happen. And so I'm telling two narratives from actual diaries and actual things that happened on San Miguel. It was possessed in two periods by – a single individual family mm-hmm. who tried to make a living raising sheep and so on. And one was in 1888, just that year of 1888, and the other was from 1930 to 1942. There was a family called the Lesters there, and the mother of this family, Mrs. Lester, had left a wonderful book. She's written about it as well as letters and so on and so on. They were taken up by the press. Toward the end of the 30s, the Lesters were, and were regarded as the Swiss family Lester. Here is this family of mother, father, and two little children
right.
Living apart in their own kingdom off of the coast, their own separate country almost. And so when they did go to shore to Santa Barbara, when the girls, the two daughters were 7 and 4, the press followed them around so that they could – photograph the children having their first ice cream cone,
right.
seeing a car.
Right. Using a toilet.
Using a toilet, having a light that turns on.
Right.
It's quite extraordinary. And they had to leave because of World War II. Don't forget, the only time our shore was attacked in World War II was when a Japanese sub bombed the Elwood oil field at Santa Barbara, Golita, without success, but it's a fascinating story, and I'm telling it just to see what that is like, which leaves me with a hankering for the next novel to go back to.
You've got more islands.
Oh, well, I'm not going to do any more islands. I'm going to go back to some contemporary black humor, dirty, crazy stuff. I just want to constantly be shifting back and forth to keep myself and my readers interested. I don't want to just do the same thing over and over.
Well, you've got, over 100 short stories that are published as well.
Well over. And I am thinking that after San Miguel, the next book will be volume 2 of the collected, mm-hmm. which will be equally fat to the first.
I understand one of the people in the studio has been reading your collection prior mm-hmm. to you coming. And, mm-hmm. you know, every night she reads a story, so she's into that.
Well, I love stories and novels equally. And one of the beauties of stories is, as with the Cheever collection, for instance, or mm-hmm. your friend reading my collected stories, you know, each one is not going to appeal to you. They're all very different.
Well, and they're written for different audiences too.
No. I don't write for different audiences.
When you write for Playboy, it's not,
no. I don't write for anybody.
Ah.
We simply sell the stories to whoever wants them.
Ah.
No. I am simply writing. I have never calculated what might sell or sell to whom or anything else. I just do what I'm going to do. Then my agent will sell them if he has many relationships with many people and you've got to spread the wealth if you're lucky and I'm lucky, you know. No, not at all. They're in different modes though, and one mode might appeal to the reader, one might not. So you skip that story or you find one that you love or one that you kind of like or whatever. That's the beauty of a collection. And it is also cumulative. You can see the workings of a given writer over time in the stories, I think, in a more conveniently than you can by reading all 13 novels.
So as an editor, are you working with an editor who's selecting how to put them together, or are you doing this yourself?
Well, I'm just thinking about it, Gil. In between the women And when the killing's done, I have written 6 new stories. That was last year at this time. And you may have seen, listeners may have seen, A Death in Kitchewank was in The New Yorker. 2 of them were in Harper's. Another was in The Atlantic. There's one in Playboy this month called Good Home, which is my take on dogfighting. And it is as grueling and horrible, stomach-turning story as you'll ever read. However, there is no actual dogfighting in it. It's about attitude. Yeah. So I hope to finish San Miguel sometime later this year and then turn to more stories. At that point, I will then take all of the previous 3 collections and this brand-new collection and arrange them in an interesting way and write a little introduction and call it T.C. Boyle Stories 2, the second volume of the collected stories. I think that might be next. I'm not quite sure yet, but I hope
well,
so.
The question obviously is then do you do them chronologically or thematically or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
In the first collection, I did them thematically for fun. I had 3 sections. 1 is love, 2 is death, and 1 is and everything in between. I think this time I would probably arrange them roughly chronologically in terms of year. Because you want to play one story off another and have some freedom to arrange them.
So do your characters reappear in your stories?
No, I've never written – I have once. There's one story that has a sequel. My first book is called Descent of Man, and it's a wild story. I was just a kid in college and I'd remembered or read about teaching apes to use language. And so it's about a relationship between – But in mine, he's called Conrad, after the famous anthropologist. The woman prefers this ape, who is very suave and very smart, to her own companion, her own male companion.
I seem to remember reading
and
this.
And so then, some years later, I wrote The Ape Lady in Retirement. And it's about a kind of Jane Goodall woman who is no longer in the field but living at home with an older chimp. And it is Conrad. So he is the only character who's appeared in 2 of my stories.
That's fun.
It is fun.
Well, we've had a delightful time. Anything you want to ask me?
Yeah. What's the square root of 12,462?
9.
You know, that's correct. That's amazing how you can do that.
I would give him that answer because you know where that comes from, don't you? Something about dolphins and
– Well, I'll ask you about your show. You seem to be having a lot of fun with this, and it's great to have this much time to schmooze and read passages of the book. I hope all your listeners worship you properly.
Well, it's interesting to have an hour-long show because you're doing the circuit. So you've got 3 minutes here, 5 minutes, 15 minutes.
Yes.
It's a conversation that happens here.
Of course.
And you can do that in maybe 15, but you can't do that in 3.
And it's very relaxing, and I thank you. People can't see where we are right now, but I thank you for the pillows and the down comforter and the nice cup of hot cocoa.
And the ladies that are carefully fanning you with the peacock feathers, right?
Yes, yes.
Well, thank you again. It's been delightful. I hope everybody will pick up your latest book, When the Killing's Done. Take a trip to the Channel Islands off Santa Barbara. Meet some characters you will not soon forget. And T.C. Boyle, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, Gil.
You have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa, where tonight's conversation with T.C. Boyle was about love, death, and everything in between, as well as how he created When the Killing's Done, his new novel about the ecological battles on Santa Barbara's Channel Islands. Our studio engineer is Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We want to invite you to tune in at 7 o'clock on Wednesday night, May 4th, when our conversation will be with mystery writer Penny Warner, the creator of the official Nancy Drew Handbook, and the Connor Westfall series will introduce her newest novel, How to Survive a Killer Seance, right here on KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa. Until then, enjoy the bunnies, baskets, eggs, and chocolate this season brings.